came to London. I went to see her in London. Waited about 2 hours in the hotel. It was exactly as before. It wasn't quite so dramatic, perhaps, as well as the first meeting. She talked very freely.
This is 65.
Mm-hmm. Talked about going to Taormina, getting Taormina prize. And she told me what the reporters are saying, that going to Rome, and so on. Talked very nicely about Moscow. She talked about her life in what's it called, that village near Moscow, and near Leningrad, where she lived. Where she died, in fact.
Yeah.
What was the name? What life was the house was like. She talked about her friends. She talked about difficulties of life. She talked about Stanov. She talked about not getting enough to eat in the 40s, how loyal some people were. She knew one knew friends and enemies were after that. It was very, very clear. Some people were brave enough to come. For example, Zhirmunsky, who had already been in Siberia by then, nevertheless continued to call. So he was touched by that. So there were various other people whose names she mentioned. Other people who gave her wide berth and speak to her. All that she talked about, very, really quite interesting, all that. And then...
How had she aged?
She had aged. She looked old. Of course, let me run...
How much older was she than you? You're not...
20 years.
As much as that? She's born in 1890.
She was born in 89.
89,
I see. Exactly 20 years older. In 65, she was... 76. And I was 56. No, I was 40. 40. Yes, 46. That's right. So, 65 years old I was.
And you were, she was 76 but hale, physically well, or frail?
No. Fat, plump, pale, rather ill looking. Not well. More with difficulty.
A stick? No.
Don't think so. But it grows and set on that child a great effort.
Did she dress nevertheless with style, or was she in...
No, she dressed in elegance. No great elegance. She was in black, with a shawl, flowers there, and
her queenliness did not... Her queenliness was entirely in her personality.
Still there. Yes. Certain her clothes. Manner, voice, style, sternness of utterance. No small talk. Every sentence weighted. Every sentence meant something. No chatter. Nothing light. No little stories. Nothing else.
What hotel did she
stay
Prattling.
In
here?
No, God, where they put her.
They being,
I think. Probably British Council, somebody, that kind of thing. It's somewhere next door to the BBC.
Yeah.
I think something called the President Hotel. I think there is one.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
A sort of third-class hotel next door to the BBC.
Yeah. Next door to Broadcasting House.
Broadcasting House. At the back.
Yeah.
As you go to Broadcasting House, on the right, as you approach it, from Regent Street.
Yeah.
Some hotel at the back there. Bombed out out of London. They built a hotel.
Yeah.
One is called the President, the other is called something else. One or the other of those. And then there appeared soon a step-granddaughter who came with her. It was called Anya. And then came a man called, from the School of Slavonic Studies, who was the interpreter, called Norman. And they were with her, more or less indissolubly, all the time. And so it's been to her. She said, why am I getting this degree in Oxford? Is it you? I said, you could say that, yes. You might say that. Et vous?
That must have given you pleasure.
Yes, some. But she was very gloomy.
Was she?
And then, yes. I mean, she didn't talk about her past. Didn't talk about Byron. Didn't talk about books. Depressed. Heavy, old, and rather more tragic than queenly. I'll tell you a story about that in a moment. Well, then she came to Oxford, and she said she would have liked to stay with us. She said that, but the embassy had made it clear that this would not be well received. So she stayed in the Randolph, where everybody came to see her, in Oxford. Painter Kolanikov from Paris would paint her mop in Leningrad, Struve from California, an editor from New York called Ruta, Sovietizan characters from Paris of various kinds. Nobody much in England. I don't think anyone knew very much. In Oxford, Bob Olensky came. In fact, she died with us. The dear of Olensky's, she wrote about to Nyman, who was a friend in Moscow, poet. And then she tremendously curled to Arlene, chilly to a degree. Very, very curled indeed. And Arlene remembers it. Absolutely. And then she said to Nyman afterwards.
What was all that all about?
I was a guest in heaven. I was uniquely attached to her, mythologically. It was a vulgarity to get married. I had no right. No
you
right.
You should have been a kind of slave in perpetuity, a kind of mythological slave.
Not a slave, but a kind of... No, not a slave, part of the myth. The lover from afar. Yeah. The, some kind of figure, unique figure in our life. Far, far, towards a nostalgic thoughts to extent. Sort of some kind of figure in a myth.
Yes.
So she was forever connected, but in eternity.
Did you feel that connection had been broken as a result of the marriage? But
well, no, I'm not sensitive enough, perhaps. I just am not. I didn't feel that she was somehow distancing herself. But it's perfectly true that she was surrounded by people all the time. When she came to dinner, there were the Obolenskis, there was Arlene. She sat stiff and dignified and regal. She talked perfectly well. She spoke no English anyway. So there's no communication with my wife anyhow. But listen to you. She said to Nyman, who told me this year, he lives in... Have you been to our house in Oxford?
No, yeah. Never.
How was it? It's a kind of little manor house outside Oxford. Governor's Mansion, Nabokov used to call it, rather ironically. She said, he lives in a palace. He lives in a golden palace. I do not approve of intellectuals living in palaces. Then I knew a lady called Salome Halpern. I haven't talked to but they're my own.
No,
let me go back. This is all video.
I think it's in the memoir. There's a reference to Halpern in the memoir.
Might be, but anyway, let me tell you who he was and what he was. Halpern was a Russian Jew who belonged to a family which had been adopted into the gentry, which there weren't very many. His father was a prosperous lawyer who used to appear before the Senate, Pravitelstvuyushchi Senat, and also was the chief legal advisor of the British Embassy. So he was obviously a prominent figure. His son had left wing rather, and lawyer, but member of the intelligentsia, Indian Petersburg, and met, perhaps not very much, people like, what do I do if he didn't? But he met somebody called Princess Andronikov, called Salome Andronikov from Tiflis, who was the famous belle of the entire intelligentsia of Leningrad. Mandelstam was deeply in love with her. He wrote a marvelous poem called Salominka, which means little straw. But the name was Salome,
yes,
so it is a pun.
Yes.
She was a friend of Stravinsky's. She was a friend of Stravinsky and Stravinsky's future wife and his then wife. A friend of the intelligentsia of Petersburg, about whom Akhmatova wrote. She was this man called the first man to whom poems out here is dedicated, who is a man who committed suicide in 1913, minor poet. let me explain. A Poem Without a Hero is dedicated to three persons. Who they are. I forgot the first name. I may remember it ultimately. Not been a murderer otherwise. Who is in love with her? Who did commit suicide? 1913. Minor poet. To a lady called something particular. Dancer. Famous actress and dancer, and to me. She began writing it in the 30s, this poem. In the Soviet Union, my name is not mentioned. Not even the last edition, which appeared, I suppose, last year. In America, it is. So it's recorded to some degree. In the Soviet Union, it couldn't be. That is clear. But it certainly occurs in the manuscript. And the first one is called, not Lvov, but something rather like it. Maybe it was Lvov, something rather like it. Anyway, helper. Here was a Jewish lawyer, video simulated, not a Jew. And when the revolution came, he went on working in the British embassy, but when the British military attaché was killed in the British embassy in Petrograd, he thought it was time to go, so he emigrated, went to London, where he became an international lawyer. I never knew anything about him or his life, but in the course of time, now she, Salome, who was this toast of the poets, also left, went to, I think, the Caucasus, and then to Paris, where she lived. And he had worshipped her, got married to her. She was a friend of Alexei Tolstoy, who was an emigre in Paris, of Bunin, of,
Berberova.
Berberova, certainly. All these people, you see. And then he married her. On condition, she made a condition. He lived in London, she lived in Paris. They saw each other, perhaps once in 2 months. Then when the war started, they did meet in New York. He went to New York, ostensibly for some Jewish charity. Actually, I think as a British intelligence agent. He worked in the British office in New York. I met him through Bill Deakin, who was I knew at Oxford, who was one of these people.
Yeah.
And there he was married to this extraordinary lady, who was brilliant and amusing, clever, rather malicious, but very exceptional. I made friends with them, I used to go and dine with them in New York, fairly frequently. And then in London, she became, so then he died, she became immensely preserved. And so did he. Not quite as much as she wouldn't get a word.
In the course of the war.
What?
In the course of the war.
No, in the late 40s.
God.
In London.
God.
More intelligent. Soviet writers could freely visit her. It was perfectly allowed by the embassy. And she used to denounce anti-Soviet talk, particularly me, to my face, which I quite enjoyed. It made no difference to our friendship or whatever. Yeah. She lived in the same house. Her companion was Anna Kalin, who was a Moscow Jewish lady who created talks on the third program. Mm. That isn't referred to in the books about it. She was a typical Moscow intellectual, high-grade highbrow. Was a friend of Helen Price Jones, Nabokov, everybody. She produced every talk on the third program, including all the Reith lectures.
Mm-hmm.
She was a brilliant, interesting woman.
Anna Kalin.
Unmarried. Kalina.
Kalna.
Kalina.
Kalina.
Kalina in English. K-W-I-N. But Kalina in Russia. She was a sort of Trotskyite to begin with, but ceased to be any of these things. Became violently anti-Soviet, and they had terrible rows every day. But nevertheless, adored each other. She died. Nyuta Kalin, she was called. Nyuta. She died, pushing about 6 years ago. I went to her little funeral. Anyway, there they were in a little house in Chelsea, and which Aline's husband bought, second husband, let them live in. And she used to, as I said, visited all these Soviet characters, And when he died, she corresponded with one of his nieces who remained in Leningrad. And in the course of this, she apparently mentioned my name, to which the niece replied, saying, "You must be a very bad man." Then she wrote back, "Say, why do you think he's a very bad man?" "Because he abandoned Ahmad." So that is obviously known. Then I talked to Naiman, the poet Naiman, who lives in Moscow. And I said, what was it all about? He said, "Dido in Aeneas." Zidona Yenye. So I see that was a myth.
Yes.
She was a tragic queen. Yes. And burnt herself on a bar.
Yes.
I abandoned her. Yes. No doubt I had my duties.
Yes.
But I did abandon her. And so Dido, if you remember, not very kind about the years.
Yes.
After he left.
Yes.
Pretending he had a good found role.
I shouldn't be laughing, but...
But it is a myth.
Yes.
That's what I mean by mythology.
Yes. What do you remember of the rest of her visit? Do you remember the honorary degree and the...
Oh, of course.
And her
of course.
Speech and all...
She made no speech. You don't have to.
Oh, that's right.
In Oxford. All I can tell you, she was there. Siegfried Sassoon got it at the same time. And the Vice Chancellor, very nicely, instead of making her go up the steps, went down... steps to her, she obviously could hardly move. Mm. You see where she went. She moved with great difficulty. She shambled and she didn't limp exactly. She walked very straight.
Yes.
Then I gave a party for her in New College, where there was a room, and everybody came and greeted her there. She enjoyed that very much. She sat in a huge armchair, and people were presented.
Yes.
See, it went all right.
Why did you seek to get her a degree? Was there some element of kind of reparation in it?
No,
kind of
none. Truth, I thought she deserved it.
Hmm.
I would have got one for Pasternak if they'd won, if they'd...
But,
well, I tried to. In 1946, I met the Vice-Chancellor of Oxford, who was a man called Sir Richard Livingstone, classical scholar, and on platform... talked to the station, and I said to him, two persons want to get honorary degrees. Who? One is a Russian poet called Pasternak, the other in General de Gaulle. Neither got it.
That's interesting.
All the other generals
yes.
got it.
Obviously on Foreign Office Bread. Advice.
No, certainly.
Yes.
Certainly. Precisely so.
Yes. She
Pasternak couldn't because nobody had ever heard of him.
Well, that raises the question of how you knew Akhmatova's poetry, how you knew Pasternak's poetry.
Because Maurice Bauer.
Because of Bauer.
Yes. Talked to me about that in the 30s. Otherwise, I had no contact
with
Soviet Union at all. I read Bloch on my own, but the first thing is...
What do you remember of your parting from Akhmatova at... when she left Oxford or left
nothing.
England?
Nothing. Nothing.
Did you feel then that it was the last time you would see her? Were you aware of
it? No, I didn't think necessarily she was going to die. I didn't think I'd never go back. I don't think I had any thoughts. I think I have a rather superficial nature.
Oh.
I don't think I was overcome by any cosmic emotions.
Because she died the following
year. Following year.
Yeah.
Quite in great honor. She was laid out in state in the cathedral in Leningrad. You see, the only person, her kind,
yes.
who was.
Yes. What do you know of Brodsky's relationship with her? It
Brodsky.
Began in sort of the early 60s.
She never mentioned him to me. But I remember what I think I told you. She received a telegram from Brzezinski, who was in England at the time. She crumpled it in a little ball and threw it in the wastewater basket. I tell that story in my memoir. I didn't mention his name. And she said, "Yevtushenko Brzezinski, They're just little bandits. That's all they are. Worthless. Banditiki.
Banditi.
Banditiki.
Banditiki.
Now let me tell you the following story. In this time in Leningrad.
1988.
Last year. Whatever you mean. I went to see a lady in Leningrad who was a friend of Brodsky. Now what is her name? I always forget it. Daughter of a famous Russian critic. Look it up. Some peculiar fate makes me forget that particular name. Zoya Borisovna Tomashevskaya.
Tomashevskaya.
She told me the following story. Great friend of Ahmad and the Wolf. She said that Pasternak quite liked his birthday celebrated, not every. One day, a special festival came, all the friends decided to celebrate it properly in Peredelkino. And rather shyly, he said, I know you don't like them, but you know, Pozniesensky and, what's his name?
Yes.
The other fellow, you know.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yevtushenko.
Yevtushenko. They've been very kind to me, and you know, they've done things for me. And they write me letters, and they read my poetry. And they're very nice to me. Do you think they could be invited? Well, I don't think the friends liked that much, but they accepted it. So they came. And the dinner was on the upper floor in the house in either Moscow or the other place, or the Dacha, wherever it was. And they sat on the other side of Akhmatova, were terrified of her. This great woman was a myth, who never met anybody. And of course they worshipped her, and out of pure nervousness, both got blind drunk. Then she rose rather earlier than she intended, decided to go away. Richter, the pianist, was sitting opposite, a great friend of both. And they offered to accompany her. Reading slightly, they accompanied her top of the stairs. Then suddenly, said Tomashevskaya, mighty hand sent them both absolutely rolling down the stairs, knocked down the stairs. They simply rolled over and over. They both fell down every single step. The mighty hand was at the Richter, she said, and served them right. Akhmatova was delighted. Delighted. So was everybody.
Incredible story.
That is the relationship. Whatever they may say in their memoirs. Anyway, no. I knew that Brodsky was close to her. She didn't talk about it to me, no. She talked about her. I knew that he was one of her poets and so on. But I didn't think she did. Didn't talk to anybody, really.
But you've talked to Brodsky since about her.
Must have done. He knew all about her and me and all that.
Right.
Yes.
When was the last time you saw Pasternak?
56. He died in...
62.
I think 60.
Yes.
Denounced. Nobel Prize and all that. 60, I think.
Let's pause. What memory...
What does stamina mean?
Stamina.
What kind of word is it? Stamen means seed.
Yes, I don't know. Stamina.
Means seed. That's the plural.
No, I don't think stamina comes from that at all.
We don't. Maybe right.
I'm wondering whether your memoir conveys some of the atmosphere, the slightly vile atmosphere of Moscow 45. I wonder whether there are other stories. Did you meet any of the kind of Kaganoviches of the world?
Well, I met Kaganovich.
Yes. What was he like?
Camille Taylor. I met her in 56.
Ah, just before the fall.
Just before the fall. Mm. There was a party given by the Indian ambassador. Like all Indians, he was either called Mehtao Singh or something like that. And he had read my book on Karl Marx for some reason, had some respect for me. So he asked I suppose Hayter to bring me. And I brought, and Kaganovich was then in charge of Russia, Soviet Union, because Khrushchev and Bulgarian were in England.
Yes.
And I met them in New College, in fact. That's another story. And I was introduced to him by the Indian. He said to me, first of all, what did he look like? Great, big, tough, bull-necked, coarse-faced gangster, Jewish gangster, or American trade union leader, Teamster Union, right. Teamsters Union, yeah. Powerful, sort of fleshy face, a huge neck, and Soviet uniform, I'm going to imagine it's a tunic. What is it? And he said to me, what are you? I said, I teach philosophy. Idealist or materialist? I said, these distinctions become rather blurred in the West. No, no, don't new variety. Don't
wiggle about.
Don't run away. This kind of thing. Materialist or idealist? I said, well, and he said, what do they read in your university? Kant? Yes. Idealist. Gegel? I said, not much.
Gegel.
Idealist. Hume? I said, yes, they do read. No, what else? I said, Hume. He was not a philosopher. He was a historian.
Not
a good. What else? God knows. Well, I said, Mill. Stuart Mill, he was not a philosopher, he was an economist. I know what you are. You're a creeping empiricist, Palsucci empiricist. That is a phrase used in Communist, which was a party journal,
yeah.
About logical positivism.
Yeah.
That very month. That's where you got it from. Palsucci empiricist. I said, well, I expect I am. He said, would you like talk to our philosophers? Would you like to have a debate? I said, well, you know, it's August. They're all sitting in the country. You all have to whip them up. Come to Moscow. No. Perfect easy. How many do you want? 40? 50? 30? What kind of number would you like? It was very difficult. I persuaded him.
What a nightmare.
Not to. But he saw a sort of medieval disputation between me and them. You would enjoy it.
Yeah.
But I then said, what else did I say to him? I'm told Jews find it rather difficult to leave this country. Is it true? That's what the Israeli ambassador said to me. He was in the water then. You see? But it's an absolute lie. Anybody can leave this country. Who wishes? I don't know what you mean. Drew's always gone like this and then turned away. That was my interview with him. Then, same year, I went, by this time I'd migrated to the American embassy. And they were invited to meet Sukarno by
the
Indonesian ambassador. Well, I was taken along as a guest. The entire Politburo was present. Other than Molotov, who was on holiday. So they marched in, first of all, no political, we milled about in the garden. And I was introduced to Shapilov, who was foreign minister, but not Politburo. We had a conversation about Oxford, England, meaning of this conversation. Everybody stood around us. People thought we were talking about terribly important things. I was asked by everybody, what did you say? What did you say? It's about nothing at all. Then Politburo came in marching in formation, 2 by 2. You see? And they all sat little girl chairs. They all drank orange juice because Indonesia is a Muslim country, even though it's a communist. And then Khrushchev, who I met in New College, when they visited, said, "Aha, they've let you in, have they?" I said, "Yes, glad they've done it. Where are these other things?" And we talked some else. And then there I met at this party Tom Dreiberg, who was visiting Burgess, but who read a book. And he asked me, he was in the figure communist, Church of England, very pious, High Church, chairman of the Labour Party, member of Parliament, and
practicing homosexuality.
Notorious, yes. And William Hayter, the ambassador, said to me, "There's a man coming to Moscow whom I think they want you to see. He is a correspondent of the New Statesman. His name is Thomas Dreiberg. Have you heard?" I then told him about Tom Dreiberg.
Yeah.
Rather shocked. He was asked to lunch. We met. Very, very courteous.
Sorry that I'm not in
recorded.
That record, but for posterity you wanted to record.
I really didn't think so. I could add something about Akhmatova's extreme anger at my marriage.
Yes, I detected that, yes.
That happened all right.
Yeah.
You see, I left her, I saw her twice in 1945. I saw her on that famous day in November, and then again I deliberately left through Finland, and not by air,
in order
to go and say goodbye to her, in Leningrad. Leningrad is wonderful. There's a marvelous Soviet piece about Peter the Great, which says he died in 1725 in Leningrad. That's where he died. Anyway, I went to see us, spent about two hours with her then.
Yes.
We talked about this and that, poetry. There was nothing in particular, people abroad. Exactly as before.
Mm-hmm.
Less dense. But still, I mean, there she was. Many places we might have. Then, I remember very well what happened. I had went to the station, and there was an injurious man who had to accompany me into the train for Helsinki. And just as I was getting into the train, the man said, "Is there much anti-Semitism in England?" I said, "No, not very much. What about America? Are you going to America?" I said, "I am going to America. As a matter of fact, there are rather more there." "Yeah, it's appalling," he said, and disappeared into the crowd.
Oh,
it's already 45.
Yeah.
We're talking 46.
Yes.
January 5.
Yes.
4 or 5, 1946.
Yes.
Then,
so the doctor's plot is in preparation, as it were.
Never ceased.
Yes.
Never ceased, that's the point. Never ceased.
Yes.
So as people, popular thing.
Well, it never ceased, but I mean,
never discouraged.
It was the only thing about Lenin for which one could have any sympathy,
Lenin
really.
Was not in the least.
He was not an anti-Semite. And
all.
The old Bolsheviks were rather resolute on that one thing,
not
and
all.
I think attracted
not
quite
all.
A lot of support.
No, not all.
Not all.
The Mensheviks were absolutely pure. The lot. There were no anti-Semites known among Mensheviks.
Tseretelli and all these people.
Tseretelli, etc.
Martov.
Martov was a Jew.
Yeah.
But there were non-Jewish Mensheviks, not very many. But they did exist. Tseretelli was one. I'm trying to think of Potrisov.
Yeah.
There's another, Vera Zasulich, Plekhanov. Plekhanov used to make anti-Semitic jokes. And for which reason, Leonard Shapiro thought he was rather married to Jews. Anyway, certainly.
The old Bolsheviks not. But then it comes back with
the vengeance. Two Bolsheviks were not. Stalin was.
Yes.
Even before the war.
Yes.
Known to be.
Yes.
And the other was a man who one of the people of the game turned out to be a police spy.
Yes.
Who was a Bolshevik deputy.
Yes.
Not Mayakovsky, it was not another like that kind of name. Lenin wouldn't believe him, though.
Yes.
But he was no doubt.
Yes. So it never stopped.
Agent. Among Bolsheviks and Gurza, rather more frequent, because perhaps they were tougher, I don't know.
Yes.
And maybe they were more non-intellectual than them.
Yes.
Military party was very intelligent.
Yes.
You know
so it never stopped, it was current. I wanted to get you back to Akhmatova, though. How do you remember that parting on the 5th of January?
I don't really tell you. I can't tell you that. All I remember was I kissed her hand and departed.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I did. I bent down, I didn't quite touch it.
Mm-hmm.
This is right, and left.
Was she the same height as you, or higher?
No, she was higher. Plump.
Mm-hmm.
She was very thin when she was young, lithe,
yes.
Athletic looking. She could bend over backwards and touch her toes, I think.
Yeah.
By the time I knew her, she was plump, rather fat, rather tired, rather old, due to eating potatoes and bread and all the rest of it. Like all these wives of Soviet.
But still regal.
Looked like very, very, extremely regal, yes. Very majestic.
Did she have other languages?
French.
And so, but when she read Don Juan, it was incomprehensible.
Totally. To me, totally.
And as you stand back from it, some of the reasons why the meeting is of tremendous resonance to her are obvious, given that you were a kind of foreign, not merely a foreign visitor, but a kind of her reconnection to the world of European letters.
Well, foreign and Russian at the same time.
Ah, and Russian at the same time.
Yes, because my Russian was sufficiently good when I was born there.
Yes.
And I knew what had happened in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
I was the ultimate Russian Jew.
Yes.
Which I am indeed.
Yes.
But what I mean is, she couldn't but
yes.
see me in that light. I wasn't a foreigner to her.
Yes.
I was not.
Yes.
It was very clear.
So all that is playing, but when you stand back from it all now,
mysterious,
what is the, why is it such a resonant encounter for both of you, do you think?
Well, in her case, because she was a tremendous mythologizer. Her whole life was lived in mythological terms. Hence, all these references to me, there are these four poems which I was made to read aloud. Some lady in Switzerland putting on some program about her sort of called Cinque. They're entirely about my visit. There's this tremendous figure, the guest in the future, who brings her nothing but disaster. He will not be her dear husband. He will not be a companion. Disaster is what he brings with him. Tremendous, fateful, fatalistic, sinister overtones.
Yeah.
Her whole life was lived in some kind of mythological dream. She knew it was, too. But she...
She knew it was. That
yes.
that implies a very complicated
well,
kind
it is,
of knowing.
Well, it is. She was very sensible, perfectly shrewd, extremely realistic, and yet somehow worked as her life. It was some kind of long string of mythological events and images. That's what poem Without a Hero is about.
Yes.
No good saying like Tchaikovsky, just past of Petersburg it was about.
Mm.
And you know, all these mysterious people come in and out.
She had this self-mythologizing character, rather like Tsvetaeva, but unlike Tsvetaeva, had it under some degree of
control. Yes, Tsvetaeva was rather hysterical. And everything was rather scattered and disrupted in a way. In her case, it was rigid control. She was extremely conscious of forms. She was very, very, she organized her words, her life, in very strict, formal way, in accordance with rules and laws, in which she believed.
Yes.
Tremendous lady is what she was. We wished to remain one.
Yes.
We knew what it was. Wish to be so.
I wonder how that instantiated itself to you when you were with her. I mean, in the way she behaved.
Well, because I was in the Soviet Union, the people I met in Moscow were Soviet citizens, one kind or another. I told you about my Russian accent, did I? I met a girl, I don't think I did. There was a man called Scott, who was Time correspondent.
Yes.
He'd been an American communist, being Donbass, and so on, married a simple Russian peasant girl called Marsha Scott. By this time he was working for Time, wasn't communist, nor was she. I talked to her. She moved freely in foreign colony France. She said, you know, you speak Russian very well. You have no real accent. You talk it very correctly, like one of us in a way. There's something funny about it, though. I didn't know how to put it. So I said, well, what? Something with your accent. She said, I think the only way I can put it is you've got a kind of Menshevik accent. I knew what it meant. It meant an intelligentsia accent.
Yeah.
Intelligentsia accent, of course. But the nearest you could get to it.
Yes.
Yeah. I knew what you meant.
Yes.
I didn't know this. When I came to Akhmatova, this was the old Russian which I was used to.
Yes.
And all our friends talked that way.
So part of her response to you was just the language that came out of your mouth?
Undoubtedly. And there was no difficulty. Everything went directly. She didn't have to adjust herself. Mm-hmm. Didn't know where I was to begin with. But when I came to the second time and began chatting, she had a friend there. The friend was also an intelligentsia lady who was an assyriologist. Mm-hmm. And then we talked about English universities, Russian universities. It flowed without any letter hindrance.
Yes.
And she then realized there was absolutely no obstacle. Mm-hmm. She could talk to me, she could talk to anybody in Leningrad.
Yes.
And did. But because I was what I was, because I came far away, and because I talked to her about my life and described what happened to me in her verse, she says, talks about me smoking thin cigar, which he blew smoke, gave him a cigar, and he talked of other loves. It was not at all what she wanted. I was then much in love with Lady Patricia as too.
Yes.
And I talked about that inevitably,
without
mentioning names. But then...
But how did you reach such a confessional level so quickly?
Because she began confessing. She began talking about her life, her childhood in the Crimea, her life in Tashkent, the people she knew, what Gumilev was like, what life was like, without, and then would read poetry. Then would come back to this. Obviously she was in a state of high excitement. Mm-hmm. I mean that, well, this communicates itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm anyhow very easy to talk to.
Yes.
About that kind of thing.
Yes.
And no letter interest, I talk very freely about myself and my life.
Yes.
And very unsecretive anyway.
Yes.
But really, but she began asking questions. I began answering at vast lengths I do to you.
I detect in your memoir, on her side, a kind of erotic twinkle in all this, a kind of erotic resonance.
On her side, there may be. Everybody in Russia who knows anything about us is convinced we had an affair. Nothing is less true. I mean, couldn't be less true.
Why are they convinced of that?
Because obviously she was obviously meant something to her, because she was a very amorous lady. She did have all these lovers. She had four husbands. Three husbands and intermediate characters. Mm. And there was this final lover who rejected her and so on. And there was Bunin, with whom she was already divorced, the last one, who then mocked her about that famous night spent with me. They disagree on jokes. Tell me that in 1946. Bunin was also sent to Siberia and wrote her tremendously moving letter about what she had meant to him. Now she was in his life, but fortnight before he died. Which she sent to me.
Oh, really?
Yes, I read it.
Oh.
You see, what she decided to send to him, showed it to me. Somebody gave it to me.
But on your side?
On my side, I was very excited, deeply moved. Mm. In love, I was not. Mm. Nothing remotely that. I just was tremendously, I was completely, I thought it was a unique moment, extraordinary night. I thought she was a wonderful person, and her poetry was wonderful, and the fact she talked wonderfully, and I had a sort of experience of being in the presence of a person of genius with whom I developed an unusual, strange, intimate relation, which was completely outside and different from anything else in my life. Building was like something in a play or a dream. strong dreamlike quality of it. Did it?
Dreamlike in the sense that it also
detached from everything else, yeah. Not part of reality.
But dreamlike in another sense is that it bonded you to that Petersburg culture from which you had been exiled.
No. I wish I could
say that. I'm trying too hard.
I wish I could say that. Wouldn't be true. Petersburg meant a lot. The streets meant a lot. And of course the building meant a lot. And of course being there is different from being in Moscow. But not all that part of my early life. It wasn't continuous.
Yes.
With something I was torn away from. I didn't feel that in some way I'd now been anywhere else. In some way I'd returned to some kind of roots. Not when I was with her.
Not?
When I was with her.
Yes.
When I walked the streets, yes.
Yes.
But when I was with her, the whole thing was out of this world. In a bubble. A balloon. You see? Not connected with the ordinary chronology.
Yes.
When I walked home, it was 11 in the morning. That wasn't a great dream. Extraordinary.
Yes.
I mean, just I could think of nothing else, obviously, for days. That's why I went to see her again. And it's just like being completely, totally, I don't know what the word is. I was impressed very deeply. Transformed is what I felt while I was with her. Perhaps that's the word. Anyway.
Did you then? This is a slightly cruel question, but did you then, in the course of time, begin to revise your impression of that experience?
No. I didn't revise it, but it faded away. I mean, it wasn't with me every day or every hour. It had been to begin with. You see?
What was it about her that impressed you particularly? Was it her voice, her whole appearance? Was it
the manner? The dramatic utterance, the sort of queen in exile, which is self-dramatized and self-romanticized. She did that. It wasn't natural. Oh no.
Why not natural?
Because it was a turn. In spite of everything, it was a turn. Who felt that she was self-romanticizing? Who felt that her voice was special? That when she talked, even in Oxford, when I would ask a question, she would answer, then she would hang her head in a very, very melancholy, dignified way and say, da, 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 da. That wasn't natural at all.
Yes.
I mean, it's obvious that she was a poet, wished to be a poet, wished to be a queen. Tragic queen is what she saw herself as in all her poetry.
But fate confirmed her in that role.
Oh yes. It wasn't groundless. It wasn't fantasy. But she made something of it. She fitted into it, but consciously.
Yes.
And somewhat exaggerated it. And somewhat framed herself into it.
What I'm then surprised at is that you could see somehow behind the mask to a much shrewder.
I couldn't help it because in the course of the conversation, she made very sharp remarks, which the tragic queen would not have made.
Sharp remarks about other people envious
yes.
ones, competitive
no,
ones, or...
No, competitive certainly. Yeah.
About
yes.
whom?
And ironical ones.
Mm. About
Pasternak.
Whom? Pasternak.
She loved him, but she was funny about him.
In what way?
Well, I think I told you, I don't know if I said it in my piece or not. She said, you know, he came back from England, and when he went to Paris, that interfered with Congress. And he came, he was terribly pale and worn out, and rather ill when he came to see me in Leningrad. And he said, I don't want to leave you. I want to stay here. I want to stay here. I don't feel well. I want to stay here. And then his wife came and collected him and took him away, she said.
Yes, I see, yes.
Collected him. And then she said, he only always said, whenever he felt unwell, he said, I want to see Arpata. When he felt low, depressed, that's what he wanted to see.
Mm.
Well, that was it, some irony.
Yes.
And then that story which I do tell, was the fact that when she came to Tashkent and saw him in Yalta, he said, have you read some recollection of poems? Which was ashamed.
Yes.
Somewhere, and she said, no, the relief, she said, was enormous.
Yes.
I realized afterwards. Well, so she talked about him in this rather, well, friendly, affectionate, but nevertheless,
yes,
slightly ironical, comical way.
Yes.
Did then she talk about other people too,
yeah,
in that sort of way.
Did she have similar...
She made jokes, you see, which wasn't, didn't fit the tragic queen. I told you what she said about Tchaikovsky.
No.
Well, she didn't like him. Great friend of his daughter, whose existence I didn't know. And I saw, I'd never heard of Madame Mandelstam. Never heard of Mandelstam's wife, not a word.
Never read any of the...
Didn't know she existed.
Yeah.
When, well, it wasn't possible. He wasn't Marshall in the West by that period.
Yeah.
Maybe there were a few translations of poems, but not much. But then she talked to me about him, of course. No, no, she didn't. When she began talking about the insult delivered by Alexei Tolstoy, which is the beginning of his misfortunes, because he insulted Tolstoy, and Tolstoy avenged himself in some way.
Mandelstam slapped Tolstoy's face.
He did.
Yes.
She never explained why. But when I said to her, what happened to him? I didn't even know. She burst into tears, wouldn't talk. From her, I didn't know he'd been killed. He'd been taken to a camp, it was too much. He was terribly in love with her.
Oh, yes.
Even, I dare say, after marriage,
oh, yes,
to some degree. She with him, I should think, to some extent. So was Pasternak, but nothing to the same degree, because he was much more self-conscious, self-protective character, and much vainer than Mandelstam.
Yes, yes.
You see.
You started off in your Scheherazadian manner to tell me why she didn't like Tchaikovsky.
I did indeed. She said she didn't like him mainly because he was, I think what she didn't like was he was a Bolshevik in 1905. And that sort of thing. Left wing. Tchaikovsky was a bastard. I mean, he was illegitimate. And he was left wing. His name, most interestingly, came to England three times. First, 1901, I think, or two, as a house painter, and bought a little penny copy of Carlyle's Sartre Resartus, which he carried in his pocket ever after, and went to the poetry bookshop, Harold Munro, and met Robbie Ross, who was Oscar Wilde's great friend, who made indecent proposals to him in a taxi cab. Second time, 1915, I think, as an eminent Russian journalist, to go with somebody else to report on the British war effort, the Russians stayed Lord Derby. Very
terrible,
different.
Terrible.
Third time, they got a degree at Oxford. Anyway, she said, you know, I never really liked him. He was ironical as drunk. He was, I don't know, he was not really a very nice man. Too envious, too double-faced, some ways. Still, he was a very good literary historian, gifted, and I mean, he suffered. So when we were going to Tashkent together, apparently they either flew in the same plane or went in the same plane, I decided to forgive him. I was going to be queenly. I was going to give him a regal pardon, she said.
She said in those
about
words.
Herself.
Царственно.
Царственно.
Ah,
я ему царственно прощу. So then she said, Корнея Иванович, what was the best time of your life? When did your joy was the most? He said, oh, no question, the early 20s. One could do anything, one could write anything. Things were free and very exciting. After that, I decided not to forgive him.
Because all her best times would
she
have been
no
prior.
Part, she was no part of the Bolshevik regime.
Yes. And all her
no
best
part.
Times were prior to the...
Prior and during, but not. She was no part
yes.
of the Bolshevik regime from 1700s. She was insulated. She never made critical remarks about it. But she lived this bubble life cut off.
Yes.
That's what gave her this pride, this queenliness, and this extreme sense of alienation resolution.
Did she have things on her conscience? It was sometimes reproached of her that she'd written poems in celebration of the party or of Stalin during the war to save her son.
Not during the war, never. Never. She wrote poems about Russia, about bombs on London.
It's rather touching poems.
No, that's all right. I wasn't ashamed of that. She wrote poems about suffering Russia, about my country. She said to me, I did quote that, that she would never leave Russia because she wished to die with our country. Unlike some people who emigrated, with the proof of it. About 2 years, she felt herself to be an intrinsic part. Russia was there, but she is Russia. That's part of the tragic queen. But when her son was exiled for the third time, which was in the 40s, she was told that if she wrote something in honor of Stalin, she might be able to regain him, or his fate be easier. So she wrote these two poems to Stalin, which she was terribly ashamed of. It did no good. Her son did not come back until quite late, 56, I think. And then she met Struve in Oxford, who told her that he was publishing them. And she was furious with him and said, if people have pistols pressed against their heads, what they say on such occasions cannot be regarded as part of their normal speech. He said, you wrote it, it's part of your works, and it'll be printed. And he did. She never forgave him, and was ashamed, angry. And I remember having a letter from Amanda Haight, who wrote a biography, lives in Australia. Say, couldn't I join with her in begging that some new edition of her poems, which somebody called something called Hirschemeyer, some American lady with a German name, was about to publish. I did write and begged them not to. Or if they did, put an appendix and explain in what circumstances it was written.
Yes.
They could do this if they wished. I'd rather they didn't write them at all than nothing of very bad poems anyway. When you read, prayed on them. And her son, nevertheless, was still angry because he thought she might have done more for him. I never forgave her. And, you know, wasn't allowed to go and see how she was dying.
Oh, really?
Nobody's clear what happened. Some people say she wanted to see him and he was kept away by mistake. Some people said he came to the hospital, advanced a certain way, and then turned back. He was in bad terms with her because she was too close to Bunin's granddaughter, and that part of the family,
yes.
Not to him,
yes.
And the jealousy, and quarrels about the will of the archive afterwards.
And he was the son by, I'm forgetting.
By Gumilyov.
And bore his name.
Oh, yes. Yes. He may be coming to, to Nottingham. There's going to be a Akhmatov festival in July.
Oh, really?
This year.
Really?
I think you might go, perhaps. I might.
Yes.
If all the eminent Russians that are asking are going to be there, I will go.
Then you'll go.
Oh, yes. Just to meet them. And then they'll all come to Oxford lunch, apparently, to see the sacred sites in which her feet once walked.
Yes.
They're doing it.
Yes.
Anyway.
All of this hero worship, heroine worship, you regard with a certain ironic detachment.
I can't help it. Certainly. I mean, she would have been extremely pleased. Her son may be coming to it. I don't know that. I was expecting him. But anyway, after that, nothing happened except that.
Did you have any correspondence with her after you left?
Not a word, no. Immediately after I left, I didn't. Then she was disgraced, denounced. I think only in 47, maybe, Bezhanov. She and Pasternak,
yes.
And Zoschenko, who I met, and in the bookshop where I talked,
yeah,
to the man who took
who
me to
was
Saravada.
The man who was the Mekka, man?
Who took me?
Yes.
Vladimir Orlov.
Orlov.
He may still be alive. He's not.
Not
critic.
O-R. No, not O-R-L-O-F.
Yes. Right. O-V.
O-V. Orlov.
Orlov, yes. He's a critic. he's written about Griboyedov and Bloch.
Oh.
And like all Russians, said to me in a loud voice, you know, Lyubov Bloch was, Lyubov Bloch was the wife, did leave memoirs which cannot be published. The sexual relationship was very peculiar. His own sexual behavior can't be revealed. He said in a whisper, basically. It was all very, very prudish. I don't know what happened to his diary. Maybe his diaries are published. He was a kind of sex maniac,
yeah,
in some ways, Bloch. And she didn't like Bloch, Bloch didn't like her. Her mother. Nor did Brodsky like her. Nor did Mandelstam. That's the thing I don't know.
But you don't correspond. What I'd like to do is, I think, now that we've started on Akhmatova, follow the story across time.
When I came in 56,
yes,
I took my...
By that time married.
I saw Preston, yes. That was the year when I was married. I married in February and went to the Soviet Union in Moscow in August.
And what was the occasion? A private visit?
We stayed... I knew two ambassadors. Chip Boland and William Hayter, who was a British ambassador.
We were both there.
With friends. They were great friends. But William Hayter became a friend of in Washington. And Boland also. And saw them afterwards and so on. And so I thought, well, I've never known two ambassadors before, why not? So I got the Foreign Office to send me more or less officially, and I stayed first in the British Embassy, then in the American Embassy. And that's where I met, I can tell you about that, where I met the Politburo. And then I went to see Pasternak in Moscow, in a building, he had a duplex flat opposite the Tretyakov Gallery. Exactly where he lived. I took my wife, he talked French beautifully, and flirted by nature with all ladies. She was very good looking, my wife, and this went very well. She was charmed, his wife was quite pretty still. I mean, rather old by then, but still good looking. And so that went on. And he said, by the way, Anna Andreevna, he's in Moscow. I said, oh, really? But she can't see you. I've told you here. She can't see you because her son has just arrived. And she thinks it's dangerous to see foreigners. I said, I quite understand. But she wouldn't mind talking to you on the telephone.